Good afternoon and welcome to the Midday. I'm Stephanie Elkins in for Norman Gilliland. And I have a special guest in the studio today, a musician with a very long and successful career that includes multiple platinum records and whose newest classical composition, Conversations with Nijinsky, was just released last week, along with a couple of other compositions in a recording by the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra. Kip Winger is my guest. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Kip.
Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know you, of course, not from classical music, but from a whole different background. Why don't you give us kind of a little thumbnail sketch of your music career?
Thumbnail sketch. Raised by my parents, who had a jazz band. My mom played cocktail drum and sang, and my dad played bass, and they had a piano, so they were a little three-piece, and they used to, we used to tag along when they couldn't find a sitter and sit in the dressing room of the clubs and listen to smoky jazz when I was very, very young.
Where was this?
Colorado. And then Christmas came, and when I was about six or seven, and my dad brought home musical instruments for all of us, and we started a rock band. So I took some piano and didn't want to read music. I just wanted to jam. So we played all the 70s music, really. I was raised on 70s pop and rock. And my band with my brothers, we were together for 12 years or so. And then 20 years old, I fled the coop and went to New York. But in between that, at 16, I studied ballet. And I heard Stravinsky and Tchaikovsky and Ravel and Rachmaninoff, and I thought, oh my Lord, somebody wrote this music. It's, you know, and it was a far cry from Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Were you a serious ballet student?
I was, actually. I took to it to like duck to water. My brother and I were in karate, so I was very stretched out. I had a girlfriend who wanted to take ballet, but none of her girlfriends would do it with her, and I'm always up for an adventure, so I took a class, and that was it. I saw people raising their legs up over their head and doing these fantastic jumps and listening to this amazing music, and I thought, this is for me. So there weren't a lot of men in ballet in Colorado in the, geez, what year was that? 76 or 77. And so I got recruited into the company, into the corps, and just I kind of did some shows with the small company called Colorado State Ballet, and ended up doing some solos. And there was a point in my life where I could have gone the other direction and become a dancer, except that I started too late and my training wasn't really quite good enough, because when I got to New York, I took class and everybody around me was quite a bit better. So I knew I wanted to do music, but I really love dance. And once you do ballet, there's something that affects you in the heart that's, you can only know it if you've actually done it. So that's my story. I went to New York, waited tables, and a producer friend of mine from Colorado gave me a job on an Alice Cooper album, played four songs on that album, said to Alice, if you go on the road, please take me with you. And he did. So I went from waiting tables to headlining arenas with Alice Cooper within 3 months.
Pretty heady stuff.
Pretty amazing. And he's a lovely guy to learn from. I say lovely and Alice Cooper, those two things don't seem to go together. But he's an extraordinarily brilliant man and exceptionally professional. So it was a good time for me to learn about all that big-time rock and roll. Played with him for 2 years and then flew the coop again to do my own band, Winger. And Alice was the one out of all of them that was like, you should go for it. So I put a band together with Reb Beach, who I'd met before in New York before I went out with Alice. And him and I were getting a lot of work outside. He had a lot of work, of session work in New York, and we made a pact to stick together for 6 months to try to get a deal. This is after shopping for a record deal my whole life. Back in those days, it was all about major labels and been turned down by everybody. And lo and behold, we got a deal off one song called State of Emergency on our first album. And first album came out and totally flopped. It didn't do anything until MTV picked it up, and then it went platinum. And we just stayed on the road for the next 3 or 4 years. And then a lot of other stuff happened.
And here you are with a classical album all these years later. And so the Tchaikovsky and the Ravel and the Stravinsky must have been percolating that whole time. So when did the classical part start for you?
This is interesting because the whole time I was really well known in a rock band touring on a major level. My band was pretty big in the late 80s, and I was just hearing classical music in my head. You know, by then I had written every rock song that I could write, and I knew it was a brand, and I love my band. We were very good friends, and my partnership with Red Beach is amazing. Having said all that, when I close my eyes, the music that I hear is orchestral music. And so my problem was I was illiterate. You know, I couldn't read a score until I was 35. So
that's a big learning curve.
A huge curve. So I'm running around on stage thinking, how am I going to write the music that's really happening in my head? So when things settled down, I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I went down to University of New Mexico and found a composition theory teacher named Rick Herman, and that's what really started it. And it was great because he just put me through the regime that you would put through if you went to music school. And it took a long time. I was, I left high school at 15, got a GED, and went on the road. So re-educating myself took a long time. I studied with three different people for about 12 years before I showed anybody my music. Michael Keurig from Blair and lately Richard Daniel Poor,
who's certainly well known. Well, you've written quite a bit over the years, and let's hear a little bit of the first piece that we're talking about, which is Conversations with Nijinsky. Nijinsky, certainly a powerful figure from the turn of the last century and the early part of the 20th century. Why did you choose to write about him? And I want to get to some music right away, so
I'll make it brief. But what this conversation is actually making me realize that this piece is the intersection between my musical background and my dance background. I was reading some books on Nijinsky, and I was writing this piece for somebody else, not naming it. And when it came around to naming it, I realized that this piece was my imaginary conversation with Nijinsky.
Neat. Well, let's hear the first movement, which is a fiery movement.
It is. It certainly is.
Chacun de Feu, which is a kind of a dance of fire.
Dance of fire.
That's right, and this is a performance by the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra. Part of the first movement called Chacun de Feu, Chacun of Fire. And of course, Chacun is a dance form. That's the first movement of music, a suite of music. Well, what would you call it? It's Conversations with Nijinsky, kind of a symphonic suite.
Yeah, that's.
And some of your music has been choreographed and presented as ballet. Has this one yet been choreographed, or do you plan
no,
for that?
No, I would love it to be. I'm shopping it around to choreographers now, and you know, it's interesting because I've come to learn that choreographers really have their own vision, and so I got very, very lucky when I sent Chris Wheeldon Ghosts. Christopher Wheeldon's the now Tony Award-winning choreographer who directed and choreographed American in Paris, but before that he's done many, many, many extraordinarily successful ballets all over the world with all the biggest companies. So I met him maybe 10 years ago and always knew I wanted to write for him. And when I felt like I had something good enough to present somebody, I presented it to Chris and just got lucky that he liked it and wanted to use it on San Francisco Ballet.
And Ghosts got some rave reviews in terms of being so atmospheric and being a great production, both for the music and the choreography.
It was one of those bullseye moments in your life where everything just came together without much effort. I mean, a lot of effort on my part writing it. It took me a year and a half to write the music. But when Chris picked it up and they put it together with San Francisco Ballet, it was truly magical. It was really something special. And what's even more extraordinary is it stayed in their rep for like 4 years.
That is.
Which is really unusual.
So a lot of people got to see it and enjoy it. And it's been in Paris and New York.
In Lincoln Center. I got to take my dad to Lincoln Center. That was pretty amazing.
Oh, he must have been really proud. That's
neat.
Yeah,
it was fun, man.
And back to Nijinsky. So this Conversations with Nijinsky. Why did you pick Nijinsky as a subject?
Fascinating character. The ground zero for male dancers in the Ballet Rouge in the early 1900s was really the center of the arts. And Diaghilev, the artistic director of the company, would bring in the best of the best. He'd bring in Stravinsky to write a score the best choreographers, Nijinsky being one of them, and the best artists and set designers and clothing designers. And I've always been fascinated with that time in music and love the French Impressionists. And I mean,
everybody. It was a pretty wild time. They were pretty loose and pretty free.
Yeah,
and
they were. They were all people after my own heart. But art on a very high level. And so for me, you can still find a lot of, what I would call like unused ideas out of little sections of, there's nuggets that you'll see in a book you'll read or a piece of music you'll hear from that time that I can pull a lot of inspiration from. So I was reading, and Nijinsky's a very interesting character because he had schizophrenia and his career was cut short at a very early age, and then the relationship with Ballet Russe went bad, and he went out on his own, and it was unsuccessful, and he started losing his mind, and when today he would be on medication and he would be totally fine. So this became this kind of dialogue of what he would, you know, if I was writing music for him to choreograph to, what would it sound like? And so I got the fourth movement got programmed by Tucson Symphony, and I get a Facebook message, "Dear Mr. Winger, what is this about Nijinsky? The name is trademark, and I'm his granddaughter, Kinga Nijinsky." And I'm like, I mean, talk about opportunity knocking. I'm like, oh my God, thank you so much for reaching out. This is incredible. I'm so honored. Here's the piece. Please check it out. And she really liked it. And
this is the granddaughter.
The granddaughter, Kinga, and she loved the piece.
Did she see it performed by the Tucson Symphony?
And so the Tucson Symphony performed the fourth movement only. George Hansen has been a champion of my music there, thankfully. He was the first one to premiere Ghost as a concert piece. So they do the first movement. I email Kinga, who happens to live in Tucson. And then she emails me back, I'd love to bring my mom, Tamara Nijinsky, the daughter of Nijinsky. So there I am sitting next to Tamara Nijinsky and Kinga Jaspers playing this piece of music with the orchestra that I wrote for her dad. It was totally surreal.
Oh, my goodness.
Totally surreal.
That must have been an amazingly gratifying moment.
It was amazing.
Let's hear another movement. This is one of the inner movements, quieter movement. Which one should we do, the waltz or the Souvenir?
I'd play Souvenir.
All right, it's called Souvenir Noir. Listening to the third movement of Conversations with Nijinsky, written by my guest Kip Winger, and it's on a brand new release that features that piece as well as Ghosts and another lovely little piece called A Parting Grace. And we were just talking while the music was playing about how hard it is for you to have the time to focus on these big, rich orchestral pieces of music while you go out and then play the stuff that probably puts dinner on the table.
Yeah,
the,
exactly.
Right?
It is. I mean, I play 100 shows or more a year, so... And it's interesting being a musician in these times because the internet has changed the game so much for the better and for the worse. So you kind of figure out how you can make a living doing music. It's a totally different ballgame. And I'll go out and play a week of gigs and come back and try to remember where I was in the midst of this hugely geometric, dynamic piece of music that I need to submerge myself back into. But I guess that's just the life of the musician.
Do you sometimes feel a little bit pulled in separate directions with thinking about pop or rock music and then thinking like a classical composer?
When I started studying with Richard Danielpour, he said a very interesting thing to me. He said, you know, you're not really a rock musician. You're a classical composer disguised as a rock musician. And so what's ended up happening to me is that the more I've studied music, the more free I am when I write rock music and the easier it is. And there actually are quite a few correlations between hard rock music and orchestra music, because the hard rock music that I've done is not jamming like the Rolling Stones style. I love the Rolling Stones, but everything we did was always very orchestrated. So it's a matter of translating that mindset into acoustic instruments on a bigger scale and then going from short form to long form. That was my biggest hurdle, was going from a 4-minute song to a 40-minute piece.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. Beethoven. Let's just keep going back to Beethoven.
And you've done it sort of the way that it's been done for centuries, which is kind of as an apprentice, one-on-one relationship, which is, you know, it used to be guilds back centuries and centuries ago where you would be a copyist for a while just to learn the master's way of composing. And now you've done the same thing where you're working kind of one-on-one with a composer. And
yeah, that's for two reasons. I don't work well in a classroom, and I never have time to go to school. I still, you know, dream about being in school because I like it. I like learning, and I like that environment and stuff. But the only thing I can do is seek out somebody that I'd want to learn what they know and go study it with them one-on-one. Because that's basically all the time I have, because my schedule is just so intense.
So are you working on anything classical at the moment?
I have, excuse me, I have two pieces working. There's the last piece on this CD is A Parting Grace, and that is the adagio movement of a bigger piece of music that I'm working on right now. And I've also got a guitar concerto for classical guitar and orchestra that I'm finishing up, that both have one movement finished and performed that I want to house in a bookend it with two other movements, or maybe three.
We'll hear A Parting Grace in a moment, but we're about a minute away from our quiz question here on the midday, so I want to give our listeners a little bit of information about you. The CD is just released literally this week, wasn't it?
It's pre-release now, and it's actually May 27th is the official release. You can order it now.
It's by CF. Those are your initials. Kip is your nickname, and mm-hmm. You've decided to not go with the serious Charles, but keep the name that you've been working under for so long.
That was a big dilemma for me.
I bet.
I really thought about that one.
Well, Kip it is, Kip Winger. And on the CD is Conversations with Nijinsky, Ghosts, and A Parting Grace that we'll hear in just a moment, featuring the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra conducted by Martin West. And you can find more information about that CD on your website at kipwinger.com and on some of the usual sites as well. And just to switch genres for a second, you're here in Wisconsin because you are gigging in our state.
I am.
You're at the Potawatomi Casino in Milwaukee tonight and tomorrow night.
That's correct.
Playing acoustic music.
Mm-hmm.
Just you and your guitar, right?
Yeah, and it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
That must be nice.
Yeah.
And then you're back again next week in Wisconsin for an appearance at Broadfest.
Yes.
In Madison.
Yeah, and I just found out today I go on at 4:30.
4:30 in the afternoon?
Early show for me, yeah.
On Sunday of Memorial Day weekend. So, well, Kip Winger, thank you very much for spending some time and some conversation and for sharing your music with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We really appreciate it.
Pleasure.